supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Today, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney announced that the Municipal Court and the Court of Common Pleas are going to church. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Next week, Enon Tabernacle Baptist Church in Cheltenham will host four courtrooms. It's part of an effort to resolve the city's backlog of bench warrants and parole violations. For WHYY, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
It's called Philadelphia Safe Return, and it's actually an old idea. Byron Cotter is the director of the Alternative Sentencing Unit at the Defenders Association. He remembers 9 years ago when about 1,300 people turned themselves in to settle their affairs with the court. Cotter says that now that the program is back, he's getting calls from all over the country.
It's a tremendous burden on someone who has these warrants. I had one woman who just called me from Georgia who has cases from 1985, has never been arrested since, and wants to get them off of her because she wants to apply for a new job, and they're coming up.
Leon Tucker, supervising judge over the criminal division of the Court of Common Pleas, says the idea is to be a one-stop shop where people can receive favorable consideration because they're coming forward on their own.
It's our hope that they can come here. We'll have courtrooms here, court staff, the DA, the PD, and perhaps even private counsel, so that at the end of the day, you walk in here with a warrant and you can walk out with the whole case resolved.
A study in 2016 found that one out of 34 adults in Pennsylvania is under some kind of supervision. That's 36% higher than the national average. Safe Return will take place May 1st through 3rd, with free transportation available from Broad and Olney to ensure getting to Enon Tabernacle Church doesn't get in the way of people trying for a fresh start. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
A new report out today broadens the focus, in particular, spotlighting Pennsylvania's distinction of having the highest parole supervision rate in the nation. Joining me with a closer look is Pennsylvania Community Corrections Story Study author Vincent Schiraldi, co-director of Columbia University's Justice Lab and senior research scientist at the Columbia School of Social Work and former commissioner of New York City Probation. Vinny, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
There are many numbers in this report, and it's a way of making sense of it. Another finds that Pennsylvania triples the national average in terms of having the highest parole supervision rate. What are some other ways to get at this?
One out of every 34 adults in Pennsylvania is under supervision, either of parole or probation. Nationally, it's one out of 53, so that's substantially higher, 36% higher. But in Philadelphia, it's one out of every 22, so it's more than double the national average.
Vinny, to put a face to the numbers, we need look no further than Meek Mill. Of course, he was released yesterday based on a mandate from the state Supreme Court, and apparently this will not have come to light in most other states.
So Meek Mill's story, from a Pennsylvania standpoint, there are a lot of things about it that are typical in Pennsylvania. Unlike lots of other places, you can get very lengthy terms on probation. An analysis done by the University of Minnesota showed that the overwhelming majority of states, you have probation terms of less than 5 years. Pennsylvania, you can get the maximum allowable. It's one of only four states. You can get the maximum allowable for whatever your offense is. So if your offense carries a 20-year prison term, you can get 20 years on probation.
Why are so many people in Pennsylvania under supervision in the first place relative to other states?
So, yeah, that's a crazy question. And I think that what happens is that it's given policymakers the illusion of safety. Sure, if some probation and parole is good, surely more must be better. And now you're up to 296,000 people on probation and parole, almost the size of Pittsburgh. There's about 303,000 people living in Pittsburgh.
Your work widely suggests that around 2 years is the appropriate time limit after a crime.
That's right. The impact of supervision wanes after about 2 years, and that's when most reoffending occurs.
Among those locally hoping to break that, what you call illusion of safety, is Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, who said this week that Long sentences, quote, put so many hurdles in front of people that they cannot help but trip. Describe the toll that this takes, this current practice takes, beyond the dollars and cents.
Well, it's about half of everybody in Philadelphia's jail is in on a probation or parole hold, and about half of everybody entering, 45% of everybody entering prison in Pennsylvania, comes in as a result just of a parole violation. And there's, I think, as a emotional example, and that is, if you focus this much supervision and this much law enforcement activity on inner city black males, at a certain point, they believe that the system lacks legitimacy. They think you're just out to trail them, nail them, and jail them. And their level of cooperation and their family members' levels of cooperation, their community's level of cooperation start to diminish. It's called legitimacy in the field. Police talk an awful lot about it, that they want to change their behavior to improve legitimacy so that people will cooperate with law enforcement because that's really the best way to reduce crime. Probation and parole have a real role to play in legitimacy, and when you're just supervising so many people and locking them back up, often for ticky-tack fouls, you delegitimize the whole system.
Can you contrast Pennsylvania with, say, New Jersey and Delaware efforts regarding probation and parole?
New Jersey has the greatest decline in incarceration of any state in the country. And one of the major ways New Jersey did this was through parole reform, both on the back end in terms of really assessing people's risk to the community and accelerating their release from prison if they were low risk, and on the return end in not violating somebody so frequently like they do in Pennsylvania. So New Jersey is actually a good model for Pennsylvania to look at in this area. Delaware, not so much. Delaware has the 10th highest incarceration rate in the country. New Jersey's 40th, Pennsylvania's 20th, and Delaware also has a very high rate of people on parole.
Vinny, thank you so much for providing some balance and perspective for our listeners on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Vincent Schiraldi, co-director of Columbia University's Justice Lab and senior research scientist at the Columbia School of Social Work. He's also former commissioner of New York City Probation. Recovery homes provide a supportive place to live for many coming out of addiction treatment. But these houses are mostly unregulated, and some in the Philadelphia region have taken advantage of their vulnerable residents. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram takes us to Bucks County, where an association of the area's growing number of recovery houses is trying to improve their image.
A few dozen people are settling into seats in the cafeteria of a senior center in Bristol. Most are current or former residents of recovery houses in the area who have come to answer questions about how they work. As he gets the discussion going, recovery house operator Scott Fleming acknowledges some negative perceptions.
This isn't just some home you buy and you throw people in and you collect rent. I know there's that goes on, but that's not what we are. So we want the neighbors to, we want to be transparent, we want you to see it.
Only a few people from the community have shown up to listen, but residents are still eager to talk about how sharing a home with other people in recovery has helped them. Abby Kirshner says it helped her learn to face life's responsibilities without drugs or alcohol.
You have a safe place to go, right? So you go to these houses and then, like, you learn how to live again, right? The stuff that they don't teach you in treatment, like how to get a job, how to do your chores, how to do all these things that, like, maybe when you're using or drinking, like, it doesn't seem like they're important things to do.
The house where Kirshner lived is part of the Bucks County Recovery House Association, a group that's grown as these facilities have proliferated in the region over the last several years, causing some tension with local residents. The houses have little government oversight, and some have been accused of exploiting people in recovery for profit. Pennsylvania passed a law in December to set standards for recovery homes that opt into a new certification program. But like the Bucks Association, participation is voluntary. But Kirshner says these efforts are helping to weed out the bad apples.
People are taking advantage of people in their vulnerable early recovery stages, and without a governing body, like, you don't know what you're going to get.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Since the February mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida, there has been plenty of discussion around toughening gun laws. Reporter Rob Zavatsky went to a recent Eagles Arms gun show in our region and heard many gun owners say they feel their voices are being ignored.
We actually think of ourselves as the gun show family. I mean, it's a multiracial family of people that come together here. I mean, we have black, white, Asian, gays, everything under the sun that comes to the gun show.
Patrick McCarthy walks through the crowd of the Eagle Arms gun show, smiling and shaking hands. He greets each patron and vendor like a long-lost cousin. As floor manager, he has already walked more than 10 miles back and forth through the Greater Philadelphia Expo Center, and he shows no sign of slowing down. He says despite all of the recent shootings and the negative attention guns have been receiving in the media, gun show business is good.
We have a good time. I mean, if the rest of the country could get along as good as we all do here, I think it would be a wonderful place to live. I mean, what we have to eliminate is the extremes on both sides and get together and have a normal conversation.
McCarthy, a collector himself, is decidedly pro-gun, but he does not advocate gun ownership for everyone. He says the folks at the Eagle Arms Gun Show are doing their part. Every licensed vendor in attendance is required to do a federal background check, and he encourages private sellers to do the same thing.
Obviously, background checks isn't the answer. If I recall the man that shot the people in Los Angeles, those guns were bought legally and possessed legally, but he killed many, many people.
Dave Holmes is one of about 350 vendors at the Eagle Arms Gun Show. He says he understands people's frustration with gun violence, but he doesn't think more laws will help.
The last I heard, it was illegal to shoot people, to kill people. So if you want to make more laws, you need to, they're made for law-abiding people. Those that are going to use a gun to harm someone else don't care about laws.
Holmes empathizes with people calling for change, but he notes the national conversation doesn't stay on gun laws for long after the latest mass shooting. He recognizes people want legislators to do something, but he says calling for a ban on assault-style weapons can be difficult when lawmakers don't understand what they're actually talking about.
Well, what's an assault rifle? I mean, you tell me what an assault rifle is, because there are AR-15s and AK-47 semi-automatic rifles here that people use to target shoot and just to own.
When people ask why a person needs high-velocity semi-automatic rifles like an AR-15, he responds with a car analogy.
Somebody says, you don't really need that rifle, do you? No, I don't. I don't need any of these. But, you know, do you need a Mercedes-Benz when a Ford will work fine?
The parking lot of the Greater Philadelphia Expo Center was full, and so was the hall. Police officers stood at the front door checking firearms, making sure they were not loaded or able to be fired. Vendors had their wares neatly spread out on tables, one lined up after the other. A handful of individuals who paid admission were there to sell firearms of their own. They walked the floor of the gun show with long rifles sticking out of their backpacks, price tags, and little post-it notes that read "Buy Me" sticking out of the barrels. But these were not the big scary guns you may associate with mass shootings. They appeared to be antiques, historic artifacts of a different time. Josh Love grew up around guns. For him, the Oaks Gun Show is a family affair and a learning opportunity for his children.
I want my kids to be educated on how things are, the way things work, what the things are, so they know how to handle them safely.
His wife, Christy, grew up in an anti-gun household. She thinks more children need to be exposed to guns to learn the proper respect for them.
Teach them. Teach the kids what a gun is. You know, they don't have to break one down, but show them. You know, show them and educate them so that they don't, when they see one laying somewhere, go over and think it's a Nerf gun. They understand the difference.
Patrick McCarthy, the floor manager, understands that there are plenty of people who do not share his affinity for firearms. His wife is one of them. He just doesn't think either side of the gun control debate is doing much listening.
That's what America's all about, is voicing your opinion. Everybody has the right to voice their opinion. Whether you like it or not, that is your right to voice your opinion, and I'm totally for it. You can voice your opinion, but you also have to listen to the other side.
For WHYY, Rob Zavatsky.
What does it take to improve America's most challenged schools? In its new season, the WHYY original podcast, Schooled, explores one controversial attempt to transform a struggling elementary school in Germantown. Joining me now is Kevin McCrory, host of Schooled Podcast. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Dave.
Kevin, having spent some 2 years following the John Wister Elementary School, Take us to East Germantown.
Sure. So the school serves a predominantly poor African-American student body, and it's led by Principal Jovan Weaver. So a big part of the podcast is about Jovan, right? He overcame this very difficult childhood growing up poor in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s. He never knew his father. His mother became a drug dealer and eventually abandoned him. So we dig into his past partly to understand better the students that Jovan now is tasked with serving as principal of Worcester. So on day one of the year, the first time he met his faculty for the first time and spoke to them, I was there, and he said to them, "I am these students, and I need you to see me in every single kid who walks through this door."
That is so powerful. I can't imagine every principal could make that statement with such candor.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly someone who is living and a career that he holds deep convictions for, and that means something to him very deeply emotionally for a lot of reasons. And I think he's pouring out, that's his words, he always talks about pouring out love and emotion and energy into kids, I think, because, you know, he didn't get that a lot when he was a kid. In this clip that we have here, we're going to hear him talk about what happened after his mother abandoned him, and you'll hear my voice in here, too.
So I'm 12 years old, Emily, and everything that I'm seeing everyone else doing, because I feel like that's what I should be doing. So I'm 12 years old, and I'm smoking cigarettes. You know, I'm 12 years old, and I'm, like, losing my virginity. I'm 13 years old. I'm drinking Old English. So looking back, I'm like, whoa, like, no one said this is not cool. No one said maybe you should stop. No one said, hey, like, won't you focus on this? No. They egged it on.
During this whole time, Jovan still had no idea where his mother was. And 3 years after she left, Jovan convinced himself that she was dead. At that point, it was almost harder when he learned that she wasn't.
My cousin, she set me down and was like, "We found your mom." It's like, wait, what? What are you talking about?
Now tell us about this non-traditional elementary school.
Right. So Worcester Elementary actually found itself in the middle of this very fiery citywide debate. In October 2015, the superintendent, William Height, proposed turning three schools into charter schools. Worcester was one of them. And then as a beat reporter, I just followed this process as it happened. And there was just such an intense debate around this prospect, as there often is around school choice initiatives, charter schools, district schools. You know, you have philanthropy, you have unions, you have all this combativeness happening. And I kind of covered that up close. And then the point of this story partly was, so what happens next? What was all that fire and energy worthwhile? Did it fail? Did it succeed? You know, who are the people who are going to be doing this? What is it at the end of the day going to mean for the kids in that school? We do have a clip of some of the debate, and where you can hear both a frustrated East Germantown parent and a retired Philadelphia teacher.
My child deserves better. My child is in a failing school.
Schools are not failing. Society, government, politicians, and school district officials are failing.
So much energy in that clip. And like you said, there are so many plays and players, each with a point of view. Presumably the podcast probes all of that.
We go into that pretty much in depth while still following that story of Jovan. And I follow through this conversion to really ask three questions. Did the change make a difference for kids? If so, why? And at what cost? So Jovan comes in, and the story is really about, can he live up to that promise of transformational change? Along the way, we do get to know the school pretty intimately through the eyes of students, parents, and teachers like Bahir Hayes.
I have multiple members in my family here who are incarcerated. My uncle died in jail because he had life. This is not just a job for me. This is like superhero stuff.
Kevin, I can't wait to hear more from this and the other superheroes in this story. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
We've been talking with Kevin McCrory, host of the original WHYY podcast, Schooled. You can find it now wherever you get your podcasts or at whyy.org/schooled, where there are also many, many great photos. And this program note, Keystone Crossroads reporter Kevin McCrory will be Marty Moskowain's guest on Radio Times tomorrow morning at 10, and joining them will be Worcester Elementary School Principal Jovan Weaver. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. It's National Poetry Month, and Philadelphia's Poet Laureate has a new work examining gender roles and Puerto Rico. We'll hear from Raquel Salas Rivera on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.